Calling the meeting to order. First item on the agenda is review and approval of minutes. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Minutes approved. I know John Sherwood is somewhere nearby. Does anybody know where he is? This is a dramatic entrance.
John Hershey's looking for
him. John has a dramatic flair. In the meantime, how are you guys?
Good.
Good?
Rick and I caught up with you two by going to Toronto, as you know.
That's right. That's right. You were trained to be an effective board member.
Yeah. Starting now, I guess.
Well, I look forward to seeing the difference. I think the red tie.
That's not in the minutes.
No. Okay. Well, we might have to skip ahead of John. If he's...
We can wait.
All right. I think Hershey just...
Yes.
Ben, if John doesn't show up in 5 minutes, we might pull you up. I'm just kidding. We won't. Guess we can move the officer election up one spot. How do you guys feel about that?
What do you want the outcome to be, Madam Chair?
Wow, we're kind of punchy today. Yeah, let's move on to item three, and then we'll catch John when he comes in. Are you prepared for that, John?
Certainly can be. Do we need a motion in a second?
Yes.
Oh, he's coming in. He's coming in.
I see.
Ho, ho, ho!
I don't know, Santa. I don't know about that look.
He's an investment officer, too.
Santa's looking a little bit.
Santa's bringing a return.
He's bringing his return.
Members of the council, good morning, for the record. My name is Santa. Jay Claus. And I want to share with you a terrific tradition that we've had at Treasury now for many years.
Santa, if your beard is preventing you from talking. Right, you look totally like Santa. You look out.
So, there are many activities throughout the year at the Oregon State Treasury, and several of those have a philanthropic objective, and probably the most successful in terms of its impact, and certainly perhaps the most fun for staff, is the annual toy drive. And so I wanted to share with the council and the audience what we're up to every time around this year. And so we have this toy drive that is essentially a race to be Santa, and each staff member contributes money towards the toy drive, and each dollar corresponds to a vote. And so this year's contestants to be Santa included the treasurer, myself, Deputy Treasurer Darren Bond, and a number of other managers in the Oregon State Treasury. And so in the race for Santa, staff over the course of a couple of weeks made donations and indicated their preference for Santa in those donations. And you can see here at one point that we had a pretty tight race. But as time wound down, the votes came pouring in for yours truly.
It wasn't close.
And I ultimately prevailed as Santa, although one of my elves told me that Deputy Treasurer Darren Bond was so intent on me winning that he would have raided his new granddaughter's 529 if that's what it took to put me into the winner's circle. So, the impact of this program is that Treasury raised a little over $2,000, $2,083. And then at that point, we handed the baton to Investment Officer Mike Mueller, who turned that $2,083 into $5,738 in retail value of toys. 195 toys, to be exact. The magic of private market leverage. We did the math on Mike's investment in that 10-day period. The IRR is so big, it requires an exponent to capture all the zeros. And more realistically, it's almost a 3x return on invested capital. So Santa wants to thank all the people that organized this year's toy drive, that included Kathy up here and Sarah and Amanda down in Salem. But most importantly, I wanted to recognize and applaud Mike Mueller for his efforts. Mike's been doing this for 18 years. And so if you just proxy this year's results and then extend that over 18 years, you get a sense of the magnitude of Mike's contribution and all the toys and all the related joy that he has brought through this annual toy drive. So again, I wanted to appreciate and thank and recognize Mike. And also, I treasure down in Salem for the Santa suit. You might notice this is a vintage Santa suit. It's from the Yves St. Nick classical collection.
I don't even know what to do about
this. Okay, I'll do more.
I think I'm gonna take a picture now from this.
Okay. He's getting prepared.
Ready? Okay, gotcha.
That's a good idea.
Okay, we got an election. As you all know, Chair Adams served out the final year of previous Chair Durant's term, but the two-year terms are decided on odd-numbered years, so we're going to do that today. We've got a manager recommendation that is important in that it's a strategy that helps us capture the momentum factor. So recall Cliff asked us from AQR, came out a few months ago and gave us an extensive tutorial and risk factors and the associated return premiums. And you might remember that second only to value is the magnitude of the momentum factor, and yet it's very hard to capture because of transaction costs. So trend following strategies such as that you're going to hear from today are the best way, the most efficient way to capture the momentum factor, and that will be an important contribution to the alternatives portfolio, as momentum is the best diversifier for value, which is our other tilt throughout the portfolio. Fixed income review. This is new this year in that we've consolidated all our fixed income activities. Historically, we've done the separate programs. We've reviewed the programs separately, and this year we're consolidating them all in one review. And then finally, we're going to update this quarter performance. And then I need to read. Santa is deficient in not having his committee list. Thank you, Chief Elf May. Okay. Since last we convened, and while Santa was up in the North Pole working away, we had some committee meetings on November 2nd. The Private Equity Committee approved a $150 million commitment to Orchid Asia 7. And then we had quite a bit of activity in Alternatives Committee on December 4th, a $200 million commitment was approved to Warwick Partners 4, a $200 million commitment to NCAP Flat Rock Midstream 4, and also on that day, a $200 million commitment to LS Power Equity Partners 4. And then finally, in the real estate committee, and consistent with the staff authority as spelled out in Investment Policy 501, acquiring and managing real estate, I wanted to report that we made some rent redemptions from the REIT portfolio, $70 million from the Cohen and Steers mandate, $854 million from the LaSalle Investment Management Program, and then we had a termination of the Talmadge separate account, which was $430 million. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll get on my sleigh and go over to my seat.
I do want to read into the record that Mr. Sherman is dressed as a vintage Santa, and I hope you will keep the costume on for the whole meeting.
It's just a little sweaty.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to item number 3.
Madam Chair, I would nominate you to continue as our chair.
Second.
Thank you. Rex, are you in favor?
Yes.
Okay, I think we're done there. Rick is silent. John seconded.
Yep.
Now I do the work. All right. Sounds good. We have Ben Carl up for Aspect Capital. Carl here today? Yes. Okay.
That was a difficult / unusual act to follow. Try my best.
Gives you something to look forward to in a few years.
Great. Well, good morning, everyone. Under consideration today is a $500 million commitment to the Aspect Core Diversified Program for the OPERF Alternatives Portfolio. You'll recall from prior presentations that 2017 represents the second year of a 3-year plan to build out the diversifying strategies allocation. That plan included hiring 2 additional alternative risk premium managers, which was completed earlier this year with the addition of JP Morgan and BlackRock, as well as 1 additional managed futures mandate. Aspect is the managed futures mandate staff is recommending to fill this slot and to complement OPERF's existing investment in the AQR Managed Futures Strategy, which was approved at the October 2016 OIC meeting. So unless there are any initial questions, I'd like to welcome Anthony Todd from Aspect. Mr. Todd co-founded Aspect in 1997 and serves as its CEO. Per usual, Calvin, Carl, and I will be available after the presentation for discussion. Thank you.
Mr. Todd, you picked quite a day to visit us. Next time, we hope to see you in a Santa costume too. Make this easier for us.
Speaking of, I've done a number of presentations in my time. It's the first time I've ever actually presented to Santa himself. It's a great honor, but thank you very much. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for your time this morning. Thank you for also considering Aspect Capital as a possible manager. It's interesting, actually, looking back, I'm the CEO of the firm. I co-founded the firm almost 20 years ago. So we actually celebrated our 20th anniversary in September this year. It was interesting, all of us just reflecting on what we aimed and set out to build when we founded the business in 1997. And the aim was, when we first of all, to actually apply momentum strategies to generate a valuable source of diversification for our clients, and to actually generate that world-class performance that we were aspiring to, and it's essential for us to invest very heavily in research and development. But along with performance, we took the view that the culture of the organization was at least as important. And our aim at the start was to build a business with a culture of trust and transparency, both for our employees and also for our clients. And I think that's very much borne out by the durability, the longevity of a number of our client relationships and a number of our employees who've actually come being with us 10, 15 years or more. What I want to do over the course of the next half hour, if we just can talk through the key elements of our investment approach, how we go about building this momentum program, I want to talk a little bit about our research strategy, because research at a quantitative systematic firm like ours is very different from research you'll find elsewhere. And I also want to spend quite a bit of time actually just talking about the performance characteristics of our momentum strategy and how those performance characteristics can provide investors with a very valuable source of diversifying, uncorrelated returns. Obviously, we've been through, I think we've got around half an hour, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Obviously, very happy to actually come take any questions as we actually come moving through. So just referring to the presentation, which I hope you have in front of you, I'm just going to move you first of all to page one, Introduction to Transfer Capital. So as I mentioned, I co-founded the firm in 1997 with Marty Lewick. Now actually, Marty and I in fact have worked together before in the momentum field, in the medium-term trend following field, for a number of years before that at another quantitative firm. So we've worked together in fact since 1992. Marty today heads up our research team, and actually he's been researching, building, running momentum models actually since the early 1980s. So actually in this field, I would say he's one of the most experienced practitioners in the area. Today we have around $7 billion under management. That $7 billion comes from a range of different investors worldwide, pension funds, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, funds of funds and private banks. You'll see on the little map on the right-hand side demonstrates our global reach. We have a team of 132 people, most of those based in London. We have a small office here in the States for investor relations purposes. Ditto a small office in Hong Kong. But the main hub of the office is in London. Of those 132 people, true to our original aim of investing heavily in research and development, we have a team of 79 in research and development. That includes 50 doctorates and masters. And I mentioned earlier the culture we've actually kind of tried to build here, and that's in an environment today where for us we're competing for top talent. We're competing obviously against other quantitative investment managers such as ourselves. We're also of course kind of competing against the large banks. We're competing against the likes of Google, Uber, Facebook, Amazon. And one of the ways that we can differentiate ourselves and attract leading talent and actually retain that talent is through that culture of a collegiate, team-based, trust-based culture.
Mr. Todd?
Yeah.
If I may, just going back to the initial statement you made that the aim was diversification.
Yeah.
I would have assumed that momentum strategies would have an aim of increased returns. Is that true, and how do you achieve both?
It's a very good question. I mean, we do aim to actually can generate positive returns over the long term, and I'll come talk about our track record a little bit later. So actually, in our main flagship program, the Asset Diversified program, we have a track record there going back over 20 years, and generated actually strong absolute returns, strong positive returns for our clients over that time. But one of the characteristics of momentum or medium-term trend following is its ability to be able to generate uncorrelated or diversifying returns, particularly during times of market crisis. So if you look in our history, for instance, we actually kind of started managing money, as I said, at the end of 1998, just as the tech bubble was kind of building up. And then, of course, we saw the so-called tech wreck in 2003. During that period, as you'll recall, the S&P nearly halved over the course of those 3 years. We were able to generate positive double-digit returns in each of the 4 years, 2003-2003. In the global financial crisis in 2008, again, we saw a decline in the S&P of close to 45%. In 2008, we generated returns in our flagship program of over 25%. Now, I think it's a very interesting question. Thank you for it. So I think it's often seen that momentum or medium-term trend following only generates positive returns in times of market crisis. Now, that's actually not the case. As I'll come on to a little bit later, the aim of the program is to capture trends, capture momentum over a period of 3 to 4 months or longer in a range of diversifying markets worldwide. So actually, during more benign market times, so if you take actually the period, say, 2005 through 2007, benign market conditions, actually a rallying stock market, we were actually able then to generate positive returns for our clients. So yes, over the long term, we are aiming to generate positive returns for our clients. We would refer to that as absolute returns for our clients. But most importantly, most particularly during times of market crisis.
And that's by means primarily of shorting positions?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily at all. I mean, actually, if you, I think it's often seen that, for instance, because we made money in 2008, that therefore we must have made most of that money through being short of stock indices. Actually, in 2008, we made most of our returns through being long of bond markets, being long of safe haven markets, such as gold, such as the Swiss franc, and actually being short of commodity markets. And actually, in fact, the nature of our approach, this is kind of cutting right into it's a terrific question. The nature of our approach is that our models are constantly in real time adjusting the positions they're taking in every market we trade. So in this portfolio, it's around 90 different markets. So constantly the models are fine-tuning the position we're taking in all those 90 markets. And we'll be adjusting that position partly as a result of the direction of the market, but partly as a result of the risk in that market. So actually in 2008, in the period of September-October 2008, when markets were collapsing, the risk in stock markets was going up, and actually we were buying back our position during that market collapse. But no, if you look at the period 2000-2003, again in the tech correct, you see a similar pattern that yes, we did make some returns being short of stock markets, but we also made significant returns to our clients being long of fixed income markets.
Mr. Todd, I have a layered question to that.
Yep.
If during benign market conditions you can outperform the market, does that outperformance include the effect of leverage? So are you, is it leverage beta versus, market alpha, I guess, for lack of a better
term? No, it's a fair point. I mean, the first thing to be clear is that we use the leverage inherently available to us from the futures markets. So the portfolio we're trading here mm-hmm. is 90 of the world's most liquid markets. Actually, to cut straight to that, if you turn to page 4, it actually kind of gives a breakdown of the range of different markets that we're actually kind of trading in the portfolio. Now, those are either futures markets or, in the case of current currencies, they are forward markets. So we're not actually kind of taking any external leverage, it's just the leverage actually inherent within the kind of futures markets.
Okay, got it. So when you say you're going long, that means the futures position.
That is correct. We will we are completely agnostic about market direction, and our models are specifically designed to be able to equally well benefit from rising markets or falling markets. So we always got to talk about the position function for our models. Position functions are symmetrical about the origin. So for us, it doesn't matter whether markets are rising or falling. What we do need to be able to generate positive returns for our clients is strong momentum or strong trends across a broad range of different markets. Times when, and again, it's always, we always work very closely with our clients to actually make them understand times when a strategy like this won't perform. Times when it won't perform is when markets are trendless, when markets are range-bound. If there's no persistent theme, no persistent momentum in the markets, our models will be constantly kind of hunting for a trend which just isn't there. The other case in which medium-term trend following or momentum will struggle will be in very sharp inflection points. So a classic example for that would actually be after the collapse in stock markets in 2008. Remember March 2009, where it seems like a long time ago, when the S&P hit 666, and then suddenly the Fed actually kind of came in with a massive injection of liquidity, and the S&P was up close to 20% over a small number of weeks. At a very sharp inflection point, medium-term trend following models will quite understandably take time to readjust their positions.
Okay, so I got it. The leverage is in the futures position.
Correct.
It's not additional traditional leverage, as we think.
Correct.
And you hold a bunch of cash to cover
that is absolutely correct.
And I assume the cash return is included in your consolidated.
That is correct.
Okay, so then looking at the four main, so I'm going to page five. We're a testy, we're a punchy bunch today.
It's fine.
The return for the last 12 months looks like we might be in one of those market periods where there isn't volatility or there isn't a particular trend. Are we in one right now?
Yeah, I would say that's a very good description. Okay. A very good description. Actually, over the course of the last year to 18 months, it's been a relatively challenging time for medium-term trend following. Now again, why is that? Well, it's because there's been such an uncertain market kind of backdrop with, in terms of, you know, by example, geopolitical, you know, kind of considerations in the Middle East and in North Korea. There's obviously been uncertainties in Europe about the path of Brexit. Obviously, kind of uncertainties here in terms of the pace of tightening by the Fed. So you're absolutely right. The last 12 months has been a relatively kind of challenging time for medium-term trend following. Actually, interestingly, if you look just most recently in October, and actually we've been running a little bit into November and December, we've seen the emergence of some kind of quite strong trends that, you know, could reappear. Obviously, we've seen one very strong trend actually persistent during the course of the year in stock markets. But during the course of October and November, we've seen a strong rally in energy markets, strong rally in fixed income markets, and also some very interesting moves in the metal markets. So actually, the last 3 months, in particular, we've actually generated some encouraging returns for our clients.
Rally in fixed income. Okay, I'm not sure.
Particularly in Europe, peripheral Europe. So in fact, if you actually have looked, so you're absolutely right, if you're looking at the feelings that you from the US perspective, actually, of course, we've kind of seen yields there, 10-year yields around 2.39, and actually kind of backed up from around 2 only a few months ago. So yes, from a US perspective, absolutely kind of point well taken. But actually, quite what we've seen is particularly, I would say, in peripheral European bonds, particularly in Italian government bonds, there's actually been a very strong rally. Ditto, actually, with uncertainty about Brexit in the UK acting as a drag on the UK economy, he's actually kind of seen quite a significant rally in UK gilts over the course of the last few months.
Mr. Todd, you opened a whole can of questions here. So, and how do you monitor geopolitical issues in your momentum models? Are they based purely on market, data?
Yeah, the models what I can do is actually, if we move to actually kind of page 7. The aim of the program, the ultimate aim of the program is to capitalize on momentum, which is a factor of where the country of assets was kind of talking to you about a few months ago. We're able to kind of capitalize on medium-term momentum. Medium-term for us means momentum over a period of 3 to 4 months or longer. I said in around 90 of the most liquid markets worldwide, covering stock markets, fixed income markets, currency markets, commodity markets. Now, the models that we run are purely price-based. So we are purely and simply exploiting that trend-following effect, that momentum effect, that momentum factor in the markets. So in terms of geopolitical concerns, we don't try to actually model what might be happening from a geopolitical standpoint. We're very much kind of taking the view that those geopolitical tensions are actually discounted in the price. And therefore, rather than kind of trying to build some complex geopolitical model, actually our approach is much more to one of taking the view that actually events such as that are already discounted in the price. And therefore, what we're aiming to do is then kind of capture that effect through a series of different momentum factors. And that's actually set out here. If you look on the left-hand three charts, the blue line is an example of an individual market. I think actually it's the Australian stock market. The red line is an example of the output signal, trend-following signal, that we would actually can take across three different speeds. So in our program, in the program proposed to you today, we, as I said, we are aiming to capture momentum over a period of 3 to 4 months or longer. We do that by applying 7 different trend-following filters. Our fastest filter is trying to identify trends over a period of 1 to 2 weeks. Our slowest is trying to identify momentum over a period of around 6 months or longer. We're slightly more heavily weighted towards the slower filters rather than the faster filters, so in aggregate, we're aiming to capitalize on trends over a period of about 3 to 4 months or longer.
So are those 7 filters the same filters for every single of the 90 products that you trade?
If you actually can take each individual filter, so each individual one of the 7 filters, each of those kind of filters is identical for all 90 markets.
Okay.
Now they are differently weighted, so we'll take into account, for instance, transaction costs, trading costs.
Right.
So we'll also kind of take into account that it's much more expensive to become trading, for instance, the copper market, than it will be to trade 10-year government bonds.
Okay.
So that is actually taken into account.
So if you're trading yen or Aussie dollar, you don't necessarily change, for example, the N number of days backwards you might look at.
That is absolutely correct.
Across all.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
And again, it's very much the philosophy of our philosophy within Aspect, is that we need to actually have statistically robust evidence before proceeding with any stream of research. So a hypothesis might be that almost intuitively you'd think that the gold market the performance characteristics must be very different from dollar yen.
Right.
Now, to actually prove that statistically is a significant challenge, and in fact the amount of data you need, you probably need hundreds of years of data to build up sufficient statistical confidence that say the copper market is actually different from dollar yen. If we just provide our researchers just the two price streams, two time series, don't actually come tell them what they are, and ask them statistically to differentiate between them, we've yet to be able to do that. Now, where we have been able to differentiate between markets is first of all obviously on transaction costs, where we actually kind of built up a very significant database of trading cost data going back over 20 years. Secondly, actually it's very interesting, over the course of the last few years, we've been able to build up statistically robust evidence that we can differentiate between financial markets and commodity markets. We haven't been able, as I said, to differentiate between individual markets or individual sectors, but in terms of super sectors, we've now actually built sufficient statistical confidence that we can differentiate between commodity markets and financial markets.
Meaning that the models might be a little different.
The models themselves are very slightly different between the two.
Okay.
But still momentum, still multi-frequency, still momentum-based.
Okay. So maybe sort of sticking to the example of an N breakout type rule.
Yep.
How frequently do you change the N?
Actually, the N, very, very rarely. It's interesting. If you look back to the inception of the business, we started trading December 1998. At that stage, we used 2 types of momentum model. Still 6 different time frequencies, still medium-term trend following. We had one, you could almost look at it as being a traditional trend following model, and another which was a breakout model, exactly the type you described. We actually migrated in April 2005 to one unified kind of set of models. Again, that's when we moved to 7 different kind of price filters, 7 different kind of time frames. Again, with the same aim of capitalizing on momentum over a period of 3 to 4 months. Those weightings have not changed since 2005. Now, it's a very interesting kind of point, because constantly, and as I said, I've worked in this sector now for 25 years, almost every time there's a slightly challenging period for performance in medium-term trend following, one will hear some commentators, some of our competitors, suggesting that market conditions have changed and the right thing to do is to slow down, speed up, but adjust that N, as
right.
You said.
Exactly.
We've always taken a very, very cautious view about that, again, because the need for so much statistical evidence. And so, for example, in the last time of challenging market conditions, 2012-2013, there was a great temptation to believe that market structure had changed. We could not find any evidence that market structure had changed. We didn't change that N. We retained our weighting to medium-term trend following, and then were able to benefit when trends reappeared in 2014.
Okay, so,
so
it sounds like from your experience that using the N breakout as an example, that there's some level of consistency, therefore a sense of sort of robustness in the models you've created, right?
Correct.
So how has correlation amongst the models across the different 90 different products that you trade change through time, and how does that impact your bet sizing?
Well, that's so in terms of bet sizing, I would probably kind of point to two kind of different effects. Again, just referring back to kind of page 7, you can actually kind of see here that the red line indicates the trend following signal of our slowest model. Where it's above the horizontal axis, it means it's identified an uptrend, where it's below the horizontal axis, it's a downtrend. The fastest trend following model is at the bottom, and then you can see that is kind of constantly, you know, adjusting its kind of position depending on the short-term price behavior. The aggregate position we take is the weighted average of those 7 models, and that comes out in the single graph on the right-hand side. So in terms of the position that we take in any of those 90 markets, it's driven really by 3 separate factors. One is just identification of trend strength. So that's the sum total signal strength of those 7 models. That's the main driver. Is the market in an uptrend? Is it in a downtrend? And how significant an uptrend or how significant is the downtrend? That's driver number one. Driver number two is the risk in that market. So actually, although we're looking for trends over a period of 3 to 4 months or longer, from a risk perspective, we're actually fine-tuning the position in every market, literally second by second during the course of the day, 24 hours a day. So as the risk of a market increases, we'll scale back our position automatically, completely automatically. That's driver number two. Driver number three is simply the allocation, the long-term risk allocation that we make to that market. That's driven partly by liquidity considerations, so we'll naturally have a larger allocation, for instance, to 10-year US bonds than we will to Italian bonds, just a more liquid market. But it also picks up on your correlation point, that actually we are, during the course of the year, roughly three times a year, we'll update our correlation model. So take into account long-term structural changes in correlation, not shorter-term effects, but longer-term structural shifts in correlation patterns.
Do you find that correlation change is dramatic, or...?
No, actually not particularly. And in fact, the specific aim there is almost not to be fooled by, you know, short-term shifts in kind of correlation. So here we're much more looking at kind of shifting correlation patterns over multiple years rather than over months.
Let me offer a simple question. When I looked at page 4 and saw all those markets, I thought there's no way that you could purport to be experts in those markets, and therefore the trades must be driven by some mathematical algorithm.
Correct.
And if that's true, where do the humans come in? Once the mathematics are done.
Yep. I mean, it's a very, very fair question. And I think, you know, where the humans, so you're absolutely right, the human simply could not actually run a portfolio this way. As I said, you know, our models, it's 90 different markets, it's working 24 hours a day, constantly trying to identify trends, adjust, you know, in the position according to risk in real time. Humans just couldn't do that, simply couldn't do that. That's why this is very much a kind of technological kind of challenge. Where the humans come in, I think, I'd actually refer back towards the start of the presentation, page 2. Because, and I think this is the point that John, you mentioned that kind of Cliff Asness actually came away from when he visited here. So actually kind of saying that momentum is actually a very straightforward concept. It's a very straightforward concept. But it's actually very difficult to manage effectively, and it's very difficult to extract the maximum value you can.
That's a point I want to pick up on in asking the question, which this detail was interesting to me, but as I was listening to it, I'm still stuck on a more fundamental question that I think is at least somewhat elucidated by your charts, but I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about how you think about how to identify when the trend is about to end. When is it an inflection point as opposed to something else? Please.
Yep, I'm happy. I will happily answer that. Can I?
Yes, of course.
Have a run at a different kind of question.
Of course.
First, and then I will absolutely come on to that. So where the humans come in, that is my two. So, so in terms of our approach is to take what Cynthia said in many respects a relatively straightforward concept. You know, momentum. We're trying to identify trends, momentum in deep liquid markets, local worldwide, 24 hours a day. Where the human element actually kind of comes in is actually then refining those models and actually trying to extract the maximum value out of a very straightforward concept. So, John, on page two, if I just talk about, say, kind of, you know, four of the important kind of areas of research. Our research isn't bounded by this, but it gives examples of what humans are doing. So, market access. You mentioned earlier that Kev Asnes highlighted that with momentum is actually possible to leave a huge amount of return on the table by actually executing those trades in those 90 markets poorly. So actually in terms of market access, we've done a lot of research to actually come try to actually come drive down our cost of market access. That's, you know, alpha one can just leave on the table if we're not careful. Risk management. I mentioned our systematic approach to scaling the position in every market we trade. That's one element. But risk targeting, how do we actually achieve the target volatility in this program? Target volatility in this program is around 18%. How do we actually kind of achieve that? How do we actually allocate to each individual market? The portfolio construction, how we actually allocate by market, how we allocate by sector. And then trend following itself. The trend following models that we are running today, although they're capitalizing on the same effect that we were aiming to capitalize on 20 years ago, they're night and day different from where they were 20 years ago. Far more refined. The work I was talking about in terms of differentiating between financial markets and commodity markets, the way we weight each individual kind of model, speed of trend following model, according to transaction costs. The position function, so once the market's in a trend, I'll come on to your point in a moment, once it's in a trend, how do we size that position? That's what we call a position function. We've done a huge amount of work over the last 20 years making refinements across every element of, if you like, the trading chain to try to make sure we're extracting the maximum kind of value out of the models. So that's the human, that's where human judgment is critical.
And that was at least a response to Rex's issue that it's basically placing the bets. You put more on this and less on that.
I mean that's another very good point. There's obviously a huge degree of judgment as to what areas of research are we going to explore. That's a very important point. As I mentioned back in 2012-2013, that was a very tough time for momentum. And there was quite a degree of pressure within the sector to change the models. There was quite a lot of pressure, people saying the markets structurally are different. Now, there's a degree, of course, it's informed by research, but ultimately it's a human decision that our view was, no, we could not find statistically robust evidence that markets have changed, therefore we did not change our models. That's a human judgment. That's born out of 25, 30 years of experience in this field. So, in answer to your question, there are two ways I can answer the correct question. As a market trend actually extends, two factors actually kind of come into play. The first actual factor that comes into play is that our position, we talk about our position function. Our position function determines from a given level of trend strength, how big a position do we take in the market. Now, as a trend becomes more and more and more extended, our models automatically scale back their positions. They'll never go counter-trend, they'll never go against the trend, so they will all be in a very extreme upward trend. For instance, as we've seen in the Hang Seng this year, our models are concerned that concerned. It's good personifying that. the model is sufficiently designed that when markets become overextended.
Just duration?
No, it's not duration, it's okay. Pure trend strength. It's actually how strong the trend has been relative to history.
Okay.
It will automatically actually just fade the position very slightly. Now, the other factor that actually kind of comes in, this is really very much the role of the faster models. So that ultimately, you know, if a market is in an uptrend, we will continue to be kind of long with that market until the trend turns. And to me, that's one of the strengths of a medium-term trend following model. It's almost inherently stop-loss. So when the trend actually reverses, first of all, our fastest models, then our medium models, then our slow models will automatically change direction. Now, it will take time. That's the March 2009 example I gave earlier. It will take time for us to move from, let's say, a pretty long position to a pretty short position. But at that inflection point, that's very much where the faster models, the faster trend models come into play.
It's just out of curiosity. So one of the things you just said is as the trend is feeling it might be a little bit more extended,
yep.
meaning that gap from when you got in is,
yep.
is growing, so you start to reduce your position. But but I'm sort of assuming when I hear that, you're reducing it by the number of contracts.
Correct.
Not necessarily percentage of the portfolio.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
Mr. Todd, I know it's hard to believe, but we've almost been talking for 5 minutes.
I'm on page two.
I know, this is a good sign. You've been very engaging. I thought you might be sensitive to your time later. We have a few more minutes for maybe a few more questions for Mr. Todd before we let him go back to his more interesting life. Much more interesting life with computers that he wrote.
I mean, one side we haven't. I hope I've given you some kind of flavour for, you know, actually how we build models, how we run the models, how we capture momentum. We haven't really talked about the performance characteristics. I think if there's one chart I'd actually refer you to, is actually page 12. And what we're actually looking at on kind of page 12, just to describe it, the purple bars are the performance of the Morgan Stanley World Stock Index. And what we're looking at here is the worst peak to trough drawdowns in kind of global stocks going back to 1980. So there are 24 kind of points here. There are 24 market significant market declines. I think some significant market decline is kind of characterized as a decline of more than of 10% or more. So you can kind of go back to obviously the early 1980s, the Volcker makeup regime. You've actually got the stock market crash in 1987, global recession and savings and loans crisis in 1990, the tech wreck 2003, and then the most recent global financial crisis and European crisis. What we're looking at here is then the performance, the red bars are a performance, is the performance of an index of what's called CTA. CTA is, that's the original term for managed futures, stands for Commodity Trading Advisor. So it's an actual index of actual managers. The blue bars actually kind of represent our performance. Now to me, what's kind of striking here is if you look at these 24 examples, there are only 3 examples where managed futures have actually generated negative returns. And in all but one instance, managed futures was able to kind of generate better performance in stock markets, and in the vast majority of cases, actually most importantly, positive performance while stock markets were falling. That to me is that's the defining kind of characteristic of managed futures. That's why over the course of the last few years, this term crisis risk offset has been attached to momentum or medium-term kind of trend following, because of its persistent ability to be able to generate these uncorrelated returns during challenging market environments.
So when you think about this history, how much of it is related to being in safe haven assets at that time?
I suppose every individual case will be somewhat different. It's a very welcome taken point, but if you kind of look over the course of the last 30 years, the last 35 years, we've actually seen a bull market in fixed income. And as a result, that could bull market in fixed income, then naturally, as a trend follower, you'd expect it to be long fixed income. So there's no doubt in kind of stock market declines such as this that that actually being long of kind of fixed income will have actually kind of played a part. But I'm most familiar, of course, with the GFC, the global financial crisis, and with the kind of tech crisis 2003. And as I mentioned earlier, yes, we actually have made money being long of fixed income. But we also make money being short of stock indices, but also being short commodity markets, and by example, long of safe haven currencies such as the Swiss franc. And actually, the spread of returns, if you look at those two particular examples, the contribution of returns is surprisingly well balanced across the four super sectors that we trade: fixed income, currencies, commodities, stock indices.
Right.
So it's not dominated by fixed income.
Okay. But, I mean, I guess the one concern I have is the value or the impact of having safe haven assets feels different now,
mm-hmm.
because interest rates are so much lower.
I agree.
Right, so the levered impact to your portfolio is going to be less.
I think that I would completely agree with that. That, you know, if you look at fixed income, 10-year fixed income yields today, 2.39. If you actually could obviously look in across Europe, they're less than 50 basis points. What can they actually provide that same level of kind of diversifying returns as we saw potentially come back in 2008 or 2003? And I absolutely can agree with that observation. On the other hand, as I said, it's worth bearing in mind that those fixed income markets going back to page 4. First of all, the fixed income markets, it's one small kind of subsector of what we trade. Within there are a number of markets actually with, in fact, relatively high levels of yield. So if you actually look, for instance, Australian bonds, Australian 10-year bonds, Australian 3-year bonds, again, they're actually kind of trading at much higher levels than we're actually kind of seeing, say, in the US and Europe. In addition, you've actually got the short-term interest rate kind of contracts, where again, I think for a while everybody thought, well, interest rates were zero-bounded. Suddenly we've actually found, well, no, they're not. Central banks really want to inject liquidity into markets. They can kind of drive interest rates right through zero and beyond. So potentially there's quite a significant scope there.
Out of respect for Mr. Todd's time, any final questions for him?
Thank you. So it's page 3.
We did read the material. Thank you so much for coming to visit us in the rainforest. We really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for the questions. It's been a great pleasure to be here. And if I can help in any other way, any other questions, then I'll be around for a little while here anyway.
Thank you.
There will be a non-stop to London in, I believe, April too. So
is that right? That would be. Yeah, I nearly missed my connecting flight last night. But that would make life a lot easier. But thank you.
Great. Thanks.
So thank you very much.
Welcome to the women's world.
It's really cold.
Great. Well, hello again. In the interest of time, I'll cut my comments short, but I guess the takeaways would be the Alts portfolio has a target allocation to diversifying strategies of 40%. And that translates to $3.8 billion at current OPRF NAV. At the end of November, we had approximately $1.5 billion in exposure, plus an additional $1 billion in committed unfunded through the JP Morgan and BlackRock recommendations. So still a ways to go, though a lot of progress has been made this year. The focus of the diversifying strategies portfolio has been very intentional and very targeted. The primary goal is to reduce the equity beta exposure in other parts of the OPRF portfolio through liquid alternative strategies that are scalable and low cost. And for us, we've settled on the alternative risk premium category in managed futures. With this recommendation, we would have identified the managers for both of those
portions of the portfolio. So in wide aspect, managed futures is a relatively mature asset class, but it's really, and I think you got a flavor of it from Mr. Todd, it's the experience of the firm and the team. It's a long history in trend following. Aspect is focused on trend following for the past two decades, and its founders are well recognized in the industry. And additionally, the firm has demonstrated commitment to research, to ongoing research, boasting a research staff of 79 people. The second would be process and portfolio transparency. Unlike many hedge fund managers, the Aspect research process is openly communicated with clients, as is transparency of positioning. And the last would be uncorrelated returns, which I know we discussed in depth. Aspect's trend following strategies have historically achieved strong performance in both up and down markets, exhibiting low correlation to traditional investments. Historically, managed futures as a whole have produced additive performance during times of market stress. This makes managed futures a unique and attractive diversifier and fit for the portfolio. Of course, that being said, there will be periods where managed futures underperform, and it's not a pure hedge. Rather, it's simply an additional source of uncorrelated returns. So, just to wrap it up, and you've heard me say this before, but when considering an investment recommendation, there are always two questions we ask ourselves. One, is it a good fit, i.e., is it additive to the portfolio? And two, is there confidence the manager will achieve their objectives? And the answer to both questions is yes.
So, the question for Santa, if I may. In my simple mind, Santa, I'm trying to put this in the band metaphor. Where does this fit?
This is the eclectic musician that can go from saxophone to harmonica. I mean, that's really Ben's portfolio is cowbell, saxophone, harmonica. Fill in the blank. You know, and that's with the express purpose of generating return streams that are less than perfectly correlated than our otherwise long-only positions in equity, be it public or private.
Yeah.
It's the most important objective we have for the alternatives portfolio is to generate positive return streams that are less than perfectly correlated with long-only positions in public and private equity.
Thank you.
So the thing I wrestle with is that if, and this is a high-level strategy conversation that maybe we'll get to at our offsite next year, if 40% of the alts portfolio is dedicated to offsetting or diversifying strategies and not seeking alpha in itself, I wonder on a consolidated basis where we get the juice, for lack of a better concept. So if we're thinking about being different, as Rex encourages us to be, I'll be really interested to see where the other 60% of your portfolio goes. I know we have some stuff in there now, but this sounds defensive in nature, offsetting, and I don't know how on a consolidated basis we get to the contribution we need from it.
I'd say it's two things. There definitely is we are looking for diversification. Well, you need more than that. It has to be worthwhile. If you want something that isn't sensitive, you know, to movements in markets, you can put your money in the mattress. That's not going to deliver any returns. So that was a key part of our planning initially. What are strategies that do offer positive expected returns as well as that diversification component? So I'd say on average, just to throw a number out there, most of these strategies across the board, so in the broad portfolio diversifying strategies, it's maybe a 10% sort of volatility and then 0.8 sharp. So you are looking at expected returns of 8% and above.
And then for Aspect, they're targeting a 15% volatility, right?
And the strategy we're looking at would be higher than that.
Higher volatility and return?
Higher volatility and return.
So
there's a mix. There's, you know, across the portfolio, there's strategies that will have a lower expected return, strategies that will have a higher expected return.
Yeah, so, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Terry, if you're in the room, but long-term equity returns are somewhere around 7.5. Seven, is that right?
Like closer to seven.
Seven, okay. So at 8% and 10% vol, we're pretty close to that. So the thing we get from this is offsetting performance.
And hopefully get no reduction in expected returns, and hopefully a smoother path from the diversification.
Yeah, so I look forward to talking more about this, because the thing that has got me hooked is, okay, we're adding new managers, new strategies that are defensive, and I want to make sure we're getting a lot out of that and not just a defensive position and complexity. You know, that's my issue.
So I'm sorry. Sure, I'd be careful characterizing these positions as defensive. If we wanted to just play defense, we just buy gold. But gold doesn't create a positive return. In fact, it has a holding cost. So the key is that they do have positive expected returns, mm-hmm. but that the path of those returns is different than the path of returns from public and private equity.
Right, so that was the chart.
They may appear defensive. I hope they appear defensive at any one point in time. But I think it would be an inaccurate characterization, because we are seeking, in isolation, we are seeking positive expected returns.
Okay, so then this is, I think, a right topic for that conversation about we're adding all these things, what do they all add up to? And I'm not stuck on that label.
Jim, if I may, I've assumed that, and you know this better than we do, that pension funds around the country are largely following each other, and this strategy doesn't work if everybody's in momentum. But then somebody pointed out that there's so much money in the vanguards that are just basically long, so that the market... Pension funds aren't that big a market to basically ruin the dance. I'm not expressing myself very well, but not everybody is doing this.
I don't think everyone is doing it. Certainly other investors are embracing these types of strategies, but not everyone is doing it. But these are unique and different types of strategies. I would characterize them as very different than Vanguard and beta, market beta strategies. It's a very different thing.
But if everybody did it, it wouldn't work. So,
it would be, individual managers would have a difficult time, if they took on too much scale. So certainly that's the capacity of individual strategies is something that is important for us to evaluate and monitor on a going forward basis.
Thank you. Russell, I would also suggest that these strategies are uniquely institutional, mm-hmm. and that the transaction cost can be so prohibited that you have to do it in scale. Mm-hmm. And so this is not a strategy that is replicable in a retail environment.
Carl, so where would, if futures have embedded leverage in them, where would that show up in your risk report, if at all?
At this point, we wouldn't be able to capture it just because of how it's being rolled up into our risk management system. Certainly, as the portfolio risk and research team is adding resources, we will have bandwidth to start looking at how to look at leverage and, say, the diversifying strategies, portfolio versus, say, public equity versus private. And so we will hopefully have resources and be able to develop reporting at a total plan level for the council's review.
And does the current risk report include leverage in other asset classes, or is it?
It does not include leverage.
So it's
period.
Not there at all. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Got it. So are those resources internal resources, or what?
Well, as mentioned at the last meeting, we certainly added Jen Plett, who's now a senior investment analyst. We have an open position for another individual to be added to the team, and that person may spend some of his or her time to further analyze the various pools of money that the OIC is responsible for, including and looking at leverage at the crossover.
Great. Any other questions for Ben, Carl, and Jim? Do we have a motion?
Move to accept the staff report.
A second.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
I thought the writing was beautiful in the memo. The editing was beautiful.
A very fine filter.
I'm sure it did. I can see it. Karen.
A bow tie, is it actually hand tied? If it is, I'm impressed.
It's not a clip-on. It took me about a half an hour this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Karen Lynn, Director of Capital Markets. I'm here just to introduce the fixed income team as they present this all-in-one review. And I must say that I didn't know my new boss was Santa Claus. So I'm going to develop a new wish list. At the end of the day, I think we all should.
One word, coal.
Bitcoin? With that, I'll give it to Garrett, who's going to be the MC, if you will.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And as always, we really love the time we have with you guys, the engagement. We hope that continues today. We have rather brief remarks prepared today and some time for questions. There's always fireways to see fit. So we have on tap today, we want to do a quick look back at the year that was and look ahead at the year that we hope to have. Second, we're going to move on and Tom's going to talk about and update you on the internal derivatives usage and the fixed income program. Next, we're going to show you the lay of the land, and those of you that have read ahead, as you guys are known for doing, it's a busy slide. We have a lot of accounts to manage internally. But we're just going to discuss the basic structure of what it is we do, how this report is prepared. This report is going to be a mainstay. You're going to see it over and over, and we'll show that consistency. So we'll briefly talk about that. And then we're going to move on to just a brief discussion of just a handful of accounts that we've selected. Then after that, it's up to you guys to take us where you want to go. So 2017 was really a year of integration for us. Well, we're going to build out the team in numbers. We'll talk about that a little bit later in 2018. We just continue to digest the Aladdin tools that we had, as well as the operations team and our compliance partners. We've just never been endowed with resources like that before. So as you can imagine, just like any company doubling in size, it just takes time. You're engaging in new activities, digesting new people, and that takes time. So that was a big thing that we accomplished in 2017, and it's going to be continuing. We also transitioned the OPERC U.S. government portfolio internally, so that marks the first time in over a few decades that we've managed OPERC fixed income internally. I'm happy to say, and we'll touch on that again in our selective account review, that's going very successfully. We're happy about that. And lastly, we're about performance. We're about risk-adjusted performance and fulfilling our goal to the pension fund and to all of our stakeholders and clients who mentioned money on behalf of. And we're proud to say that performance is strong across the board, both relative and absolute. So moving on to 2018, it's going to look like a different team next year. We're adding a significant amount of positions, including new leadership for the team, and also that's incumbent on us to continue talent development as we engage on new activities and face new market risks that those of us here and those of us will hire, we just need to continue to sharpen up. Second, and this is the most important thing I want you guys to take away from what we talked about today, is we're going to come back in 2018 with a new OPERF fixed income benchmark review. That may involve recommending a change to the benchmark. We'll talk about it in a little bit more detail when we close out our remarks. But the point here is just to, we have a very prescriptive benchmark, right? And that can lead you to not having as much staff creativity and, well, we don't have complacency today, it can lead to complacency when you have an overly prescriptive benchmark. And second, most importantly, the fixed income, over fixed income goals change. That is to be more diversification towards equity and equity-like risk. And we just want to make sure that our benchmark at the top of the house is aligned to that, so then staff is looking to look for mandates and look for managers that can best do that. So those are some important things we want to do.
What are the alternatives that you're looking at?
I think the easiest thing to look at and the first thing we'll look at, again, we're going to take our time and do a diligent study about this, right, both qualitatively and quantitatively, would be a much more generic benchmark, much like the U.S. Aggregate Index or the U.S. Multiverse.
index that just encompasses broad fixed income, is generally high quality and has more duration than what we currently manage to, therefore is highly likely to be a better fit for the goals of diversification against equity. And yet by having more generic benchmark, less prescriptive, less detailed, it allows staff to be more opportunistic and innovative in bringing new mandates and new thoughts to the table.
How do you integrate global global fixed income into the benchmark?
I argue right now you don't. With JGBs taking 10 basis points to the 10-year mark, and previous guests mentioned German bonds are trading at 35 basis points. European high yield yields are lower than the 10-year U.S. Treasury in the benchmark level. I just, you don't. Right. Can't leave the future, sure, but...
Mexican 10-year treasuries are a little bit higher.
Yeah, Indonesia and Brazil and Argentina's 100-year bond is pretty yieldy as well, but I just argue we probably shouldn't go there.
Oh, you want a freer benchmark, but you have some boundaries, huh?
I think you always have boundaries.
We know this game here. All right.
Well, obviously, bonds have both yield and appreciation, and I think you could argue that a low yield in Europe, for example, might offer more appreciation. So, but
it has the future ability for it to could be questionable, but it has had appreciation.
This is foreshadowing. Do you want to open the benchmark box?
Well, just you might like the US tag and US multiverse, not the, the global multiverse. So we're not putting JGBs and yen denominated bonds yet. And just to close out here, it's program enhancements. I just want to mention that with all these new staff and new capabilities, it's incumbent on us to kind of create a new engine to do things differently. And we kind of have an R&D team and we have a manufacturing facility, if you will, where we are creating ideas, getting them in the portfolio. We have an operations team and outsourced partners, BlackRock and State Street, to kind of make people build that machine out and make sure it's running. So it's just incumbent upon us to get new tools and start doing new activities to make sure we're constantly reinventing that and improving that factory, if you will.
I hate to keep bothering you with questions, but I mean, I'm having just come back from Toronto, where some of the people were from CalPERS with a staff of hundreds. Is there anything we can learn from those sorts of funds where the staffing is already bigger about how they manage fixed income and how they utilize their staff?
Sure. We do have some anecdotal evidence of that, which is with our interactions with our peers, and they just tend to be very much more focused. We tend to wear a lot of hats and do a lot of things.
Sure.
There's the benefits and detriments to both. I don't foresee us ever getting to a CalPERS level staffing. However, it's definitely, if we get more people in, we're going to be able to focus more on certain sectors of the market and become more experts.
No, I wasn't advocating that we become a staff at 300. I'm just saying that if presumably that those organizations have discovered things that we might find useful, that's all.
That's possible. Yep. And moving on, I'm going to turn over to Tom to talk about derivatives.
All right.
Thank you, Eric.
So as we discussed and as the council approved, first part of 2017, staff has implemented the usage of U.S. Treasury futures in the pension plan in the U.S. government portfolio. As we discussed at the time, while we have experience in capital markets with the utilization of U.S. Treasury futures, it was new to fixed income. So the implementation from our end process was very deliberate. We took our time adding, and really the hurdles that we encountered were really more on the operational administrative side. You had independent systems that you had to get up and get working. You had independent groups that you had to establish communication lines with, and procedures that you had to establish, daily cash management procedures, operational procedures. You had the different various vendors. You had Aladdin. How was it going to display our risk analytics? Was it going to display the metrics that we needed, internal commissioning? You had the electronic trading venue, broker account setups, custodian processes, custodian permissioning, those type of things. Each one of those had to be tested. All of it had to be tested together. That took some time. It took more time than probably we would have liked, but it did. So when we were able to get those all those processes together, we took on a very tiny position, just a couple contracts, make sure everything worked together, went through a month in, contract roll, make sure everything that we expected to see happened as we expected it. Everything went pretty smoothly, as we wanted it to. We've now increased our exposure to treasuries and, or excuse me, to treasury futures. And so far, from a management standpoint, from a portfolio management standpoint, the management has been fairly smooth. It's working pretty smoothly.
Well, here's that busy slide, I promise. When you look at Treasury's fixed income program as a whole, we manage $37 billion across 24 accounts. Internally, we manage $23 billion across 13 unique accounts. The way we think about it is across four different categories, and those are the vertical columns that you see there. And that is the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, the state agency and local government accounts, which there are many different customers and clients within that group, State Accident Insurance Fund, or STAFE, and the Common School Fund. Now, the way we prepared this report, and for those of you that are ahead, we're not going to go slide by slide. This is a very busy report. For each of the blue boxes, you'll see in there that each one has a corresponding page, and only one page here. It's consistently showing the strategy, objectives, the benchmark, the manager. And here's a snapshot at a high level of what we're doing. Each one also has some more detail in the appendix. So again, we intend this to be a mainstay, this type of reporting, so you guys can get a holistic view of everything it is that we manage here. As you can tell, it's quite busy. And this understates a little bit. This is kind of at a September 30th seasonal low. Angela will talk about it, but short-term fund digested property taxes here, and we peaked out an all-time record in the short-term fund late November, just over $21 billion in that fund, which boosted our internally managed assets about $6 billion higher than what you're seeing here today. So with that, we're just going to talk about a few accounts. So we're going to jump around. Hopefully you guys don't get screen nausea behind us as we flip through some of these things. They're very colorful. We're going to lead off with Angela talking about the short-term fund, and Tom's going to talk about the Oregon Intermediate Fund Pool, give you guys a brief insight into the smaller state agency accounts we manage. And Tom will go on to talk about the OPERP government portfolio and how we have implemented that, how we manage that, how it's internal. And then I'm going to end talk a little bit more about the benchmark and talk about OPERP's fixed income program at its highest level.
I do have to say that having Sherbone dressed up up here takes the edge off. So, short-term fund, I'm going to just start with a quick reminder of what the fund is and who participates in it. This is a short-term cash investment vehicle which serves OPERF and nearly 1,000 state agency and local governments. Year-to-date, our NAV has ranged from $14 billion to a high of, as Jared mentioned, $21 billion during property tax season. And per policy, we have three objectives. First and foremost is preservation of principal. Staff carefully manages and maintains our weighted average credit quality for the portfolio. That objective is followed by liquidity and yield. And I think the only thing I want to highlight here off of this slide is the coupon type exposure, which is especially relevant today since the FOMC is meeting as we speak. In a rising rate environment, we continue to favor LIBOR-based floating rate notes, and this helps us be positioned appropriately for what we expect to see in 2018, possibly three hikes from the FOMC. And to build off of the comments Garrett made about 2018 and what staff is looking forward to, one of the unique things about short-term fund is all of the local governments who are stakeholders. And so we continue to work on our outreach to them, both educating and informing them about the resources Treasury has to offer.
Angela, what are the triple B assets that are in that fund there? So if it's liquidity, I assume, I can't remember the three characteristics, but what would be the triple B assets that you'd invest in there?
I'm going to let Gary go ahead and answer
that one for you. Is this my annual question about
yeah.
the thing that, okay.
Well, it's not ABS this year.
Okay, all right.
ABS, but he was prepared.
Yeah, sure. We utilize, first of all, these are downgraded securities. We can only buy A minus or better rated securities.
Okay. All right. So they're just grandfathered.
I'm happy to report that we held on to them because the upgrading agencies were a little complacent in what they were doing, and they finally upgraded Bank of America Holding Corp. And we sold some other positions because it's been such a bullish market. So by policy, we don't have to sell them when they get downgraded. But we do hold on to them because there's usually floodgates of selling. It's not a good time to sell.
Okay, so Bank of America Holding Corp, that's car loans? What's that?
Bank of America.
Right, the actual?
Yeah, we invest a lot in the bank operating system, which is AA plus rated. Mm-hmm. But the holding company, which used to be A minus rated across the board by the major three, basically downgraded BBB plus to Baa1 by Moody's. And recently they started to upgrade these banks again.
Okay. So then whenever we get to the slide that causes me to think about my annual question, will you make sure that you point it out to me, please? And I also will note, having looked at your report now for several years, I could see the difference in the work here. Really, really, really appreciate this. This was very helpful. So as someone who's seen now 4 years of this, I paused on this and thought, have I seen this before? This is really good. So thank you for the hard work that you're doing.
Fundamental question: Are the local government entities obligated to use the short-term fund? And if not, what percentage, roughly?
The state agencies are obligated to, but the local governments are not. So that's part of our goals for the outreach, is to just make sure they're aware of this option. If they are utilizing an advisor or possibly investing on their own, it may behoove them to put their money with a short term fund.
Roughly, in among government entities, there's global and the non-state, do we have half the market?
It's hard to know how much the market we own. There's a statutory cap on how much they can invest in those systems, bank lobby laws to encourage local governments to deposit local institutions to help the communities. Mm-hmm. So currently they can invest just over $40 million. They are allowed about a 10-day period of having overage, like in property tax season, because we are the deposit account and they have to handle that money as they get it. So there are some transitories to go above that. And that is increased every year by CPI, Urban or Portland, to allow that to continue to grow. But the fund, traditionally, excluding property tax times, about 50% assets are state agency pension and 50% local government. But in terms of numbers, given that cap, we have nearly 900 local government participants in the fund. We're unsure who's not in the fund that could be, or what other assets they have. So that's not something we're able to get to easily.
So with that, I'm going to take the council through the other state agency and local government funds, excluding the foreign short-term fund. So I'm going to take you quickly to page 11. You'll see the Oregon intermediate term pool. So essentially what I'm going to do, we're going to split the grouping of the state agency and local government accounts up by management style, total return, fine. We'll go through the two sets. And then I'll start the conversation with the pension plan, as Gary mentioned earlier, with the government portfolio. So here on page 11, you'll see the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool. It's one of three portfolios that are managed for state and local governments for total return. If I can just make some broad characteristics of the total return portfolios. They're all mostly managed against benchmarks with maturities of 5 years or less. They're all double rated, and they're all diversified across a number of fixed income security types. The intermediate term pool here, I think, is representative in the fact that it is below its benchmarks interest rate risk. And it is, or it has, gradually reduced and overweight to corporate credit risk while adding weight to agency mortgage-backed securities and maintaining them to asset-backed securities. And I think all three have generally been managed in that general direction over the past 6 months. So with that, I'm going to skip you to page 14. We'll talk about quickly about the separate accounts on the drop-down scheme that Garrett put together early on. You'll see six state agencies. There's eight accounts listed here, but it is across six state agencies. These accounts are managed in close communication with the respective state agencies. They each have bespoke guidelines that were worked out between Treasury and the respective state agency. Those guidelines all fall within the guidelines for Council's Policy 402, which sets broad exposure and diversification guidelines. These portfolios are all essentially managed for buy and hold mandates. That means when the money is invested, they're not invested for near-term price change. They're essentially invested. The monies are invested for long-term capital return. The maturities are generally laddered or spaced out based on communication with the respective state agency based on their liability structure. And then the monies, as they do become available for investment for each one of these accounts, they're invested for whatever maturity bucket or diversification we're trying to achieve. They're invested for a higher return relative to the respective treasury at that point in time. So with that, that broad description, are there any questions about the state agency accounts?
So, Tom, do you work directly with the agencies? Like,
yes.
One of sorry about that.
Okay. So, generally, I'll have 1 to 2 formal presentations for each of the state agency accounts each year. But some I talk with or speak with monthly, and some almost weekly. And we're working things out as needed.
Mm-hmm. And are these funds generally like general account excess funds if there's no liquidity demand on them? Do you know?
It depends. For gas is an insurance type mandate. For others, Department of Veterans Affairs, those are longer term, essentially savings account type monies that can have a little more total return flair to them. And then there are others that, like lottery, which are essentially directed by lottery, and very, no credit risk. Essentially, very very simple, just matching maturities.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
So, with no more questions about that, we'll take you to the pension plan assets. So, I'm going to flip you back to page.
Page 7.
And we'll start off with the government portfolio before I turn the rest of it over to Garrett. Just very quickly on the government portfolio, as Garrett mentioned, we transferred it from four managers to an internal consolidated. We took it from approximately I think it was about 300 positions down to about 45 positions. So, over some time, it's essentially all either U.S. Treasury or instruments backed by U.S. Treasuries. The overriding mandate for the account is to minimize interest rate risk relative to its benchmark. You can see in the graph on the right there, we're matching the benchmark's interest rate risk profile almost exactly. There's an appendix on page 25 where we break that down into even more detail. And you'll see that we match it very closely. And that's really the overriding mandate from our standpoint for managing this portfolio.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, we're going to end our prepared remarks just talking about the OPR fixed income at the aggregate level. First, just at the bottom, performance is crucial to what we do.
What page are you on, Garrett?
Six. Sorry, though. It's been another good performance year for fixed income, both on relative and absolute terms, given what the market is giving us. Now I just want to briefly talk about those three bar charts and why they're important, why we've presented them.
The first bar chart is the strategy weighting. That is, we think of ourselves as having three components underneath the OPER fixed income, and that is the government portfolio that Tom just talked about, which is our purest expression of that diversification and hedged equity risk. Moving on down the risk and return slash excitement factor, we move into the core fixed income, which is about a 46% allocation in terms of capital, benchmark weighting. And that is managers that manage actively around the U.S. aggregate index, which again is about one-third U.S. investment grade credit, one-third securitized assets, which is predominantly means about 91% U.S. AAA U.S. agency mortgage-backed securities. And then the other third is U.S. Treasury exposure, which the U.S. government portfolio managed is the component of the ag pulled out, that exact exposure. Right. And so if you start to move from left to right in those graphs, we start to pull the sectors out of those benchmarks, strategy weightings, you get into that benchmark column, and that's where you see that our allocation is 55% U.S. Treasury, and the remaining exposures being a handful of 14 percentage points in U.S. investment grade credit, about 14% U.S. securitized product, and the remaining in the bank loan and high yield strategies that we expose ourselves to. And as you see on the very far right, that's just a reflection of what we actually held as of September 30th relative to those sectors. And just ending on kind of the discussion about the benchmark, you can see our benchmark when I talk about it being prescriptive. It's very detailed, and it's actually a reflection of what we actually hold. And so our benchmark review process that we're going to go through in 2018 and come back to you guys with the results of is going to make sure, first of all, is this a good benchmark versus other benchmarks in the market for our goal of being diversification, first and foremost, and secondarily, liquidity and income providing to the pension plan? And if not, what should we propose that's a better fit for that? And overarching that, we prefer a more generic benchmark that allows staff, it kind of creates a culture of more creativity and innovation, and it gives us the ability to think about mandates that might not be exactly these weightings, but in a risk and return standpoint are additive in total to get us back to a risk profile that's similar to benchmark. But we think better fulfills our goals and aligns us to our goal. So with that, we're happy to take questions about this or any other topic.
Can you talk a bit more about the benchmark? To what extent are you limited to benchmarks that already exist? To what extent to pick up on your theme of what creativity a new benchmark would allow you, do you look at a mix of existing benchmarks? I'd like to know more about how you're thinking about that process.
Sure. I think that a mix of benchmarks, again, gets you overly prescriptive, and I would argue, well, our benchmarks serve us well, it may be a superior benchmark to one we recommend, we'll think about that in our study. The problem is with having a prescriptive benchmark, if you get the best idea or markets change, things change, and you have what you think is a great opportunity, it's very hard for staff without first coming to the board and asking for a benchmark change, then bringing the manager up that now plugs that new hole. You really don't have the flexibility to think about adding anything new. And the way I think about this is if you get a more generic benchmark, like I mentioned, like a U.S. aggregate or U.S. multiverse, much like how public equity has the ACWI, and then they come and ask for or bring recommendations that they think can get that return better but have less risk, right? It allows us to structure ourselves the same way. So in that exercise, we would first work with John and Carl and team and think about, is this treasury portfolio the best way, and what size should it be in order for us to be the best hedge we can with the capital that we want to put in that type of mandate? Then that allows us then to look at that exposure and backfill to our risk budget into other mandates that we think get us back toward risk and return profile to the multiverse of the ag. And why am I bringing those up? Those are just broad U.S. benchmarks. They generally have greater duration, which is generally more defensive and gives us more of that equity hedge. But it allows staff that ability to think about mandates that look like can get us to a risk profile similar to the benchmark we think have the potential to have a greater return and better align with the goal.
This issue of benchmarking, though, is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
There are two ways I think of your issue. One is what the benchmark is, and then how much variance or adherence we require to whatever the benchmark is. And then the role that your asset class plays in the portfolio. So the benchmark conversation is one that leads to a number of other connections that we certainly want to hear John's perspective about changing that benchmark. Having lived through some of the difficult times when benchmark adherence and fixed income was a very important part of keeping the lights on, so to speak. But look, it sounds like we'll hear that later in the year or next year. When's the benchmark conversation coming?
Well, first and foremost, we're going to more than
think about
team size in 2018, and that'll
okay.
be the first hurdle. But we're certainly already thinking about it. We're laying the groundwork internally in our heads and getting some of the data lined up. But it's a 2018 event for sure.
So there may be some changes, there may not. We may propose a benchmark change, but it may be the replication and result may look very similar with some of the bands that you just described. But maybe no change.
Yeah, just putting up a flare, I'm really sensitive about this in this asset class. So I wouldn't want it to be a discussion that presents research and a sort of conclusion. I'd rather that we go through a process of really batting it back and forth and thinking about it.
So if we were to just look at the Barclays aggregate, what is the current weighting to U.S. government?
In the two flavors of mortgage-backed securities, which are AAA, the agency guaranteed market, as well as the treasuries, it's about two-thirds of the aggregate index.
Okay, what about just treasuries?
About a third.
About,
yeah.
So U.S. treasuries is only about a third?
Of U.S. aggregate, correct.
Of U.S. aggregate,
okay.
So I guess one of the questions I have is, I guess a little bit more of a strategic thinking question is, what is our goal in terms of how much U.S. treasuries we want to have in the portfolio? This is from when I first joined the council, the fixed income portfolio had a little bit more of an overweight to credit. Now I think my understanding is we're trying to move a little bit closer to a little bit more of a overweight or reliance on treasuries. So ultimately, is there a thinking on where we want to get to?
I guess I would categorize the evolution as less an emphasis on overweight treasuries and more an emphasis on removing the embedded equity risk that had been in the portfolio. It's still in the portfolio in the form of high-yielding bank loans. But those two sectors in particular were a much greater proportion of the overall fixed income. And so if you stand up in front of you and point to fixed income as a diversifying asset class, and yet have this embedded equity risk and high yield of bank loans, then we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. So it's less emphasis on what we're going to overweight, and broader than that we want to essentially de-risk the portfolio, so it really is the anchor to windward that we're telling you it is.
Okay. So,
and that's also part of what Garrett is saying, why it's very prescriptive. Right now, we have codified what we own in the form of a prescriptive benchmark,
right.
But that's not necessarily what we want to own or should own.
Right.
And so a broader benchmark would actually facilitate the transition to what I would suggest to you is a better portfolio, where the definition of better is more appropriate vis-a-vis its role, and its role is anchored to windward.
Right. We carry on this discussion at another point, because I do think that having a better understanding of, I mean, I guess from my perspective, what I want to hear is, what do we want to hold? Well, what is the proportion of the various types of securities we want to own? What are we working towards? I guess this is really my question. Rather than thinking about it from a benchmark perspective, which I think in some ways is limiting.
It's actually the same question, because
it is. It's just a different
right
way
now,
of looking at it.
The prescriptive benchmark locks us in.
Right. Exactly. So it's I agree with it. It's the exact same mm-hmm. thing. It's just the starting point is different. Right, so I'm trying to get the benchmark out of my head and think about, and I'm trying to ask you, what is it that you want to hold? What do you want this portfolio to look like?
Ben, when was the last time the benchmark was changed? I see you back there, Alan. Sorry, after he answers this question.
I think you're saying the same thing in a different way. The key is what is the goal of the asset class.
Right.
And once you have a finished statement on that, then you can say what part of the bond market does affect that objective. And I think that goes back to the reason to have the bond portfolio is to diversify equity risk. How do you best construct your portfolio? And so I think you end up in the same place. It's just a slightly different conversation.
I completely agree. I guess what I'm saying, though, is it's a little bit different in the sense that I don't want the benchmark discussion to lead the construction of the portfolio. I would much rather have the philosophy dictate how the portfolio is constructed, irregardless of the benchmark.
And I argue that's your start point, is the objective,
right?
I've prematurely given you a few just broad examples. But we're not sure where we ultimately will end up on the benchmark. As Perry mentioned, it may be a composite again. That's not ideal for us because it, again, somewhat locks you into owning certain things when you have percentages in front of you.
It does. I mean, it's the same thing in the public equity market. When we're using ACWI, it ties us to that benchmark. And I would argue that the level of active risk we might be willing to take is being really constrained by that benchmark selection.
Well, in a broader sense, too, what others are doing, I think they're creating in the space, is they're thinking about their portfolio in fixed income more broadly, and they're having what they call a rates allocation, which is just a pure expression of that treasury hedge component. Then they're having a completely different silo of credit, which might encompass things we're doing in other asset classes within the plan, and allows you to refine that allocation a little bit better in terms of risk-adjusted returns and credit more broadly.
Right.
And perhaps that's kind of now getting out of the fixed income world. I can't speak for other asset classes, but that's another way others are getting over that hurdle. Yeah. And then they're laying their allocation to rates and getting it done in that expression.
That sounds interesting. Look forward to it.
We'll be back.
Any other comments? Super, thanks. Let's take a 10-minute break. I'll see you back at... Okay, kids. We have Carl and Janet up.
Hello. I will just skip ahead to the relevant page, which I would say is page number 4. There are a couple things that I can address on this particular slide. One, just to tie back to our earlier discussion with Aspect Capital, the allocations to diversifying strategies, the objective is to essentially expand the size of that red box, basically, to get more diversification in the portfolio. This is a simple schematic that is covering a lot of complexity that was discussed during break, and certainly that's something that we could address in the future OSD meetings. But again, the objective is really to improve the diversification so that we get a better risk-adjusted return for OPR. The other takeaway from the slide is if we look at the total predicted risk for the third quarter, it was about 7%. If you compare it to about a year ago, that's a 5% decline from where it was in 2016. A big driver of that 5% decrease is essentially comes from what's going on in the market environment. Equity market volatility, is low, at all-time low in some cases, depending on which proxy you use. So if you, for instance, look at the implied volatility of the at-the-money option of the S&P 500, the VIX index, the volatility at the end of the third quarter is essentially at the low since the creation of the index, so since back to 1990. If you look at a short-term rolling realized volatility of the same index, third quarter is the lowest since first quarter of 2007. So, there are a couple of takeaways you can get from that. One, actually, if we just move on to slide number 6,
Carl, if I may, on slide 4.
Sure.
What do the numbers mean on the vertical scale?
So these are, we look at each portfolio in isolation, and we scale it by the weighting of that portfolio within OPR. So At a later slide, you can see that equity has a predicted volatility of about 9%. At a weight of about 40% within OPERF, that results in a standalone risk for just that sleeve of about 360 basis points. And so, again, tying back to your aspect, you know, that strategy, if that was a standalone investment we see on the same slide, they're targeting a mid-teen percentage volatility. So we would see that as having a stack, another blue stack, if you will, of a series of stack charts. But because they're targeting a risk that is orthogonal to equity or over a full market cycle to be uncorrelated with equity returns, then we would see like that allocation to the aspect would actually increase the size of the red box and thereby just decreasing the overall volatility, of predicted volatility for OPERF.
Okay.
So moving to slide number six, the point I want to make here is that...
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. So this page four is our estimate of predictive volatility?
This is the estimated predictive volatility for the different portfolios and for OPERF.
Okay. So the predictive volatility is about 7% right now?
Correct.
Okay. So I guess the question I have is that too low?
You know, so I guess the point here is that the reason, you know, we saw a 5% drop in predictive volatility over a full year is because essentially equity markets have declined. And
okay.
The point is that equity risk is around 82%, 85% of OPERF. And the second point is...
So we're using market volatility as the input?
As the market volatility as an input in how the risk management system estimates risk for the different portions of the portfolio.
So when you say predictive, it's using market data, not our opinion of what volatility could look like.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then I guess the second point to that is that, as it was mentioned during break as well, is that we are market takers of returns and risk. So we saw a lower risk, the risk management system is therefore using a lower predictor risk, which is why OPERF risk dropped by 5%, down to about 7%.
Okay. How would this look if you, instead of using shorter-term volatility, you use longer-term volatility?
It would actually, we would see a same drop. The exact number, I will have to go back and look at it, but even if we look at a rolling five-year returns, which is five-year monthly volatility, we would see also OPERF's predictive volatility drop quite a bit since last year. And I guess the other point, though, is that even though we are essentially market takers, that doesn't mean staff is sitting around waiting for the market to give us what it gives us. The OIC approved several changes over the past year and a half that were implemented over the last 12 months that resulted in a lower predictive risk. So a couple of events or a couple of changes that occurred within the public equity portfolio. The OIC approved a 25% allocation to global low volatility strategies. Staff has made allocations to those strategies in 2017, and they expect to reach about 15% of the public equity portfolio, which lower the risk of the equity portion of OPERF. Within the real estate portfolio, the council approved back in early 2016 a rebalance away from REITs and into more core open-ended funds. The real estate team, as you heard at the beginning of this board meeting, defunded some of those REIT strategies, and that also reduced the contribution of risk from real estate. So all in, those two changes that have been realized in 2017 has lowered the predictive risk by itself by about 40 basis points. So staff and the council have made changes to the portfolio to try to make it more efficient and lower the portfolio risk. And things that the council have also approved but has not been reflected in this report, nor likely at the end of 2017 this report, is that the allocations to three diversifying strategies over the past few board meetings, as well as to the currency overlay manager. So we expect those allocations to also improve the efficiency of OPERF.
Carl, I really appreciate the explanation about what we've done up here in this slide. It would be great in the future to add that summary so that we can keep revisiting.
Yes.
I might ask a kind of pro forma version of that, too. So if we do fully fund that all of the diversifying strategies, whether it will further reduce the risk, I assume, by a couple 10 or 20 more basis points over there. So that would be helpful.
And then have we done anything that actually isn't doing what we thought it would do, or do what we thought it would do to the magnitude that we expected in terms of reducing risk? We want your, you know, to tell us when we're off course as well.
Sure. Certainly I think the council has made a lot of great decisions. That's not what we're looking for. Okay.
Great stop there.
By we, I mean all of us collectively.
That is what I think collectively staff and I imagine council as well is trying to figure out, revisiting our decision. I'm personally not the kind of person to be 100% confident in anyone's decision. I always feel like there's a wide error bars to anything I decide, and it's always worthwhile to go back and revisit them. That being said, we've had the system for a short period of time, over a very attractive investing period. Again, equity risks are at an all-time low. So it's hard to have a lot of out-of-sample data points to see how our decisions are really affecting OPERF until we actually get more volatility in the marketplace. But that is definitely one of the purposes of my role at the Treasury, and I'll certainly be monitoring that going forward. And really, I guess the last takeaway I would say is just go to slide number 7. The only thing I would add here is, versus a year ago, our equity allocations, and that's including public and private equity, we're now about 5% overweight the strategic target. Certainly equities have had a great run, and as Jana will go into further details. But we will reduce some of that equity allocation at the end of the year as we implement those changes, as we rebalance into the individual account program that the council approved back in September, as we defund some of the public equity portfolio to make changes to the whole targeted fund structure. So we should be closer in line with our strategic asset allocation after the end of the year.
I'm just going to take a few minutes and talk a little bit about the economic commentary for the record, Janet Becker Wolf Fallon. Chair Adams had requested that we also include in our commentary some sort of back of the envelope attribution on some of the factors that the council has put in the portfolio, whether they've worked in or not worked. And bearing in mind, of course, that some of the measurement periods are extremely short and don't reflect the purpose of those changes. They're just relative to what the markets have done over a fairly short period of time, so I'll do that as well when we get to the total fund performance. But on this page, it gives you just a little bit of a backdrop of what's been happening over the last year or so. And you can see economic growth has been very strong. The second and third quarter GDP numbers came out around 3% each, so we're on track for a pretty good growth year. That growth has incorporated a significant amount of consumer spending, which is good for the economy. 70% of GDP is consumer spending, and consumer confidence remains at all-time highs, which means the markets are going to do well and consumers are continuing to spend. Along with that very strong GDP growth, we've seen extremely strong profit growth. The S&P 500 earnings for the third quarter were very strong. Much of that came from tech stocks, but across the board strong, and energy is stabilized, so energy earnings are up too. So there's some fundamental underpinnings towards this sort of long-dated bull market. Inflation is still really low, 2+ on the core number. If you look at unemployment, we're down to 4.1. So the economy is kind of humming along here with no apparent inflationary pressures, not from capacity utilization or from wages. Wage growth, even at 4.1%, unemployment has been around 2.5%. So we just haven't seen inflation tick up, and the Fed, has a dual mandate of inflation and employment. Employment is low, growth is strong, the markets have been strong. I think there's a 98% probability they're going to raise a quarter today, and there's a very strong, and they already done it? All right, well, there's 100% probability. I mean, it was all baked in. I mean, I don't think anybody thought that wasn't going to happen. But, you know, next year, now there's an expectation that there could be up to three. So we're kind of in this rising rate environment. If you look globally, too, you can see that central banks, for the first time, are kind of starting to move in the same direction. They're in different phases. But, of course, we're under the Fed is unwinding the balance sheet to the tune of $10 billion a month, expected to ramp that up in 2018. So we're seeing more bonds come into the market, et cetera. So there's a good feeling about global growth, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere as well, especially Europe. So just looking at the performance asset classes as our periodic table, if you do a quick snapshot, and each of these colors represents an asset class, of how the markets have done from the best at the top to the worst at the bottom over these kind of multiple time frames. So you get a little bit of a short term in the last quarter and a longer term on the 10 years. But what you'll notice is that for the last quarter and the last year that there are just some phenomenal absolute returns from various components of the global equity markets. Emerging markets up almost 23%, small caps up almost 21%. So these are some very big numbers. ACWI, XUS, 19.6. So everything, you know, we're really looking at the lowest equity return of greater than 15% year over year. So very strong returns from equities and from international in particular, because that has been lagged, and now it's sort of pulling ahead at least for the year in terms of the Russell 3000. So the international markets are starting to pull their own weight. We saw a strengthening dollar at the end of last year post-election, that the dollar sort of fallen off in 2017, and that has been the wind at the back of U.S. investors in foreign currencies. So if you look at year-to-date, so sort of bringing this from 1 year to year-to-date, Russell 3 is up 20%. ACWI XUS is up almost 24%, and the AG is up a very modest 3.3%, because we've had sort of a pretty straight line bond market, not much going on in the bond market. Some inter-quarter volatility, but not much going on otherwise. So looking at the next page, this is sort of a summary of the OPERF total regular account. So broken down by the total fund, and then by individual asset classes, fixed income, public equities, real estate, opportunity, alternatives, and private equity. And what you'll see is for the quarter, the total fund was up 3.7%, and that was 30 basis points ahead of the target. So that's great. I mean, these are great absolute numbers, but if you look at the last 12 months into September, so the one-year period, the fund is up 12.7. That's a very strong return, and that's against a target of 12.3. Fixed income, as we talked, had fairly modest returns, 0.73 for the quarter, and for the year, I think it's 1.12 on your portfolio. And then on public equities, at 5.7, that is underlying the U.S. equity at 5.1 and international at 7. So international has been quite strong for both the quarter and the year. Real estate, we look at longer-term numbers, 10-year numbers for the real estate and opportunity portfolio, 4.8 and 6.5% respectively. So very strong annualized returns over long-term periods. Alternative portfolio is obviously in transition. As you know, you're building the diversifying assets portfolio. But strong returns really across the board. Private equity, 8.6% over the last 10 years. So I want to just make a quick comment on this page. As you see, we have the actual asset allocation on the left, and we have something we call the interim policy target in the center, and the strategic policy target on the right. That's kind of the end game. What you'll notice the big difference is here in the different colored pies is that alternatives in the interim mix is 5% as you're starting to build the diversifying assets portfolio. The ultimate objective is to get to an alternatives portfolio of 12.5%. And as was previously discussed, about 40% of that's going to be in diversifying assets. And we will modify that interim target as we see the assets grow in the alternative space, so the interim target reflects the current funding's pace, if you will. And as Carl mentioned, we're going to kind of wait till the beginning of next year when the dust settles from some of these other reallocations before we adjust the targets and some of the other assets get funded. So there's a lot of other information here, but I thought if you don't have any questions on that part, I would talk a little bit about sort of this back of the envelope attribution.
So one question on slide 5, the opportunity slice, does it get absorbed into the alternatives bucket there in the strategic policy target?
It's part of that, it's the entire pension plan. So if there's 2% of the opportunity portfolio, it takes it from every piece of the pension plan. It's not just from, say, the alternatives portfolio, it's not from, you know, everything is part of
it. So the strategic policy target is 0.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's no.
So
anything over 0, it takes it down from everything else.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
So just with the caveats I mentioned before about this back of the envelope attribution, it does not reflect the purpose of these biases that are currently existing in the portfolio. So one of the things that I think has to be discussed is the private equity versus public equity. And as you know, their diversification over the last 3 or 4 years, even 5 years, hasn't worked really well. Where you really want it to be is 100% in S&P 500. That's probably it's been the best performing. So having a private equity component that underperformed the public equity component has been one source of differentials, if you will. So with public equity, the private equity portfolio, it hurt only over the quarter and the year. So if you go out to 5 and 10 years, is where you expect private equity to lead, especially given the very strong, particularly large cap U.S. market, that it's helped over the long run, but it's hurt you over the kind of shorter term, 1 and 3 year periods. One of the other things that you have is a strategic objective, which was the de-risking of the bond portfolio. So the treasury versus aggregate, if you will, so a pure risk, sort of a risk-free asset versus a more diversified exposure, that has hurt you in the 1 year period and the 1 quarter too, as credit spreads have continued to contract and credit has outperformed treasuries. Mm-hmm. So that has hurt you in the short run, but clearly has a purpose and a mission over the long run of de-risking that portfolio, providing diversification to equities. And someday equities will fall. Don't know when that will be, but then you'll be glad you have the treasury portfolio, because that's when the treasuries are really going to provide that hedge. But in the meantime, it's been a little bit of a cost. That hedge has cost you a little bit. So within the bond portfolio, having a credit exposure, you have about 17% of the portfolio in credit, below investment grade credit, has been good, and that has helped over really the quarter of the year and the 5 year period, because credit spreads have come in and credit has dramatically outperformed the aggregate and treasuries.
And Jen, is the below investment grade credit in our portfolios is managed externally, right?
We have two below investment grade portfolios that represent about 17% of the fixed income portfolio. So it's kind of broken down. 37% of it is in treasuries, 46% in a broad aggregate mandate, and then 17% with two below investment grade managers that have blended benchmarks for leveraged loans and high yield.
Okay.
So that's a component of it. That component in this time period of kind of a risk-on environment where equities have done well, credit has also done well. So that portfolio has beaten both the aggregate portfolio and so that's been additive. The other couple of things that you have is a value bias, and that really hasn't worked out that great, as growth stocks have sort of dominated the value, both in large cap and small cap. But again, over the long run, we expect value to do well. Just in the short run, that the markets have really been pushing growth, especially in the tech sector, as you know. And the other is smaller capitalization, which has actually worked over the quarter of the year, but in some longer-term time periods, that has not been as probable as we would expect. So that's just a quick summary, kind of a little scorecard, if you will. But again, I would make sure you keep in mind there are specific roles for these individual components of the portfolio, that their performance in the short run is not really material to a decision on whether you keep them or you get rid of them, because they have very specific objectives over a very long time.
Understood. I would love to hear those points of view on what's working and not working on a regular basis for us, and keep our attention on it. I would only take note if over one of our entire term, that something we thought would work didn't work, and if market conditions change. So it's really more just a discipline than, I think, reactive on our part.
And we're happy to kind of retool this presentation to be a little more focused on that as opposed to just really broad.
Yeah, you're the most interesting person in the room, Janet. We want to know what you think. We do. And you have a point of view, seeing lots of clients and a lot of market data that we'd like the full benefit of. Super. Any other questions for Janet and Carl?
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you in the new year.
Thank you.
John, I'm a little late. Sorry, buddy.
That's okay. Item number 7 is asset allocation and maps. The only noteworthy comment really is all the three pictures on the map charts. Halloween, so those have gotten prettier since. And then tab 8 is preview of coming attractions.
Might be time to change the scale.
Yeah.
No more space at the top. Okay. Anything notable in coming attractions?
We haven't set a date for the strategic issues discussion. We're going to kick off the project with a revisit to the investment beliefs at the beginning of the year, so we'll probably play that out and get a sense of how that's proceeding, and then identify a date sometime in February.
Sounds good. Anything else from you, John? This is usually the time we have for discussion. We're at item 9. I have had off conversations with each of you. Are there new issues you'd like to talk about that are front of mind?
Well, one of the things that Rick and I learned in Toronto is just be sensitive to relationships with other pension funds. And there are people from CalPERS and CalSTRS there who have people, staff people, who are assigned to maintain contact with other pension funds. And on issues where there's value in numbers, if you really want to move the needle on governance issues, CalPERS isn't big enough. We're not big enough, certainly. But I understand that we now have people assigned to that very task. Is that the case?
I don't think we have anybody assigned explicit outreach responsibilities. But what I will say is there is and speaking for myself, among the public plan CIOs, there's really terrific camaraderie. To the extent that I think one of the most gratifying dimensions of this role for me has been that camaraderie. I was CIO at Northern Trust for 7 years, and I can attest that the CIOs, the asset managers, and the private trust companies never got together because we were competitors. And this is a totally different vibe on the public side, where we get together regularly, informally once a year, and there's a tremendous amount of information sharing and assistance. And again, it's one of the most gratifying elements of public service in this role.
I'd add to that, the same is true amongst treasurers and staff. So I think we are always looking for those opportunities, and more of them are emerging.
Well, John, I thought we talked a little bit about someone taking on governance issues.
Oh, sure. So as the investment division expands in 2018, the additional resources are going to be employed, and then the additional resources give us the luxury, finally, of having some specialization in areas like corporate governance, in areas like ESG.
Would that person, though, have the authority to fly down to Sacramento periodically and discover?
Sure, and we do that now. So Dave Randall and I last year went down to Sacramento and spent a day with our counterparts at CalPERS. And because they are much further along on the build-out of their middle and back office functions. Mm-hmm. And Dave doing his role, and we had, you know, Aladdin just in, and so that was a very valuable exercise. So we are, believe me, Member Russell, we are not shy about stealing ideas from our peers.
Well, this is, I was talking particularly about ESG issues because a CalPERS board member said that they have a person whose job it is to solicit cooperation among pension funds like ours on joint efforts, because without that, governance issues just don't get done. So I gather we have somebody, or will have somebody, who they can talk to here.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Other thoughts? Issues front of mind?
No.
I neglected to introduce Mr. Stephen Marlowe, counselor, sitting in for Dee. He's an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. Shame on me, Counselor Marlowe, for not introducing you sooner. Appreciate you babysitting us today in Dee's stead. If there are no other points of discussion among the board, we'd like to open it up for public comment, if we have any. Wonderful. See you in the new year. Yeah.